forward on the bed, folding his jeans, his shoulders ready to clutch, to crush around her. She felt a snatch of old feeling, a visceral pull towards him. A hot bolt of love went through her. "It's Sunday tomorrow," he smiled. "We can sleep all day if we want to." He took a hanger out of the wardrobe and flipped the jeans onto it, encouraged by the softening in Melissa's face, that look in her eyes just now. She lay back, half waiting. He put the hanger on the rail. It was a weak rail, something else that needed fixing. Twice already it had collapsed, bringing all his clothes to a pile on the floor. And as he turned back to his fine, supine woman, now ready to ravish her, it chose to do so again, with tactless and unkind calamity. His trousers, shirts, jackets and jeans came toppling out onto the floor, making him swear. "Why now?" he said. "Why fucking now? It needs fixing. I can't fix it now. I don't mean now, I mean just some time." Melissa felt sorry for him, as he came towards the big bed, annoyed, with the floorboards groaning beneath him. He hated the mess of clothes there, the disorderly heap waiting for the morning. But distracted and pissed off as he was not going to let a wardrobe, an alleged mouse, or a draft spoil his chances. Naked, except for his underwear, which had been carefully chosen earlier that evening for tightness and flattery, he lifted the covers on his side of the bed and got in next to her. The moment was ruined. They both sensed. It would take a lot to get it back. And it was so late now. The birds were actually singing. But the last thing that dies in mankind is hope. "Just come here," he said, and smelt her neck. Her neck had stopped smelling of chicken around 7 years ago. Now it just smelt of her shea butter. Still, he searched for it, sniffing at her, his stubble making her itch. She scratched. He tried to ignore that she was scratching. She wrenched her neck away from him, cat-like, and he moved downwards to the vicinity of her milk-designated chest, which he could not really suck with any degree of self-respect. But what the hell? "I'd rather you didn't do that," she said. She felt his hardness against her leg, and resented the obligation that she should do something for it. She just didn't feel like it now. And it bothered her, not just that he had proposed to lap at her shore of milk, but that he had started on the left. He always started on the left. The monotony and the lazy lack of adventure in it distressed her. "I'm tired, Michael." "Oh, don't be tired," he said. She lay back. Her arm flailed limply around his neck. He kissed her stomach, but he could feel her retreating from him. She was not with him. He tried for a little longer to see if he could call her to him. Then, unwilling to make love alone, he also retreated. No, there would be no love tonight. He stilled his hands and sadly drifted. A helicopter was circling in the skies over Bell Green. A lone siren went by. From the wide stretch of land at the top of Westwood Hill, the Crystal Tower loomed and shone red. The palace was no longer standing. It had burnt to the ground in 1936, after a long and steady decline. Chapter 2. Damien. "Damien!" Stephanie called from the landing. "Do you know where the purple fitted sheet is?" Damien was in the kitchen, wearing his pyjamas and dressing gown, in the pocket of which was a single decrepit Marlboro Light that he had found with an un-non-smokily joy at the very back of the vase cupboard above the fridge about 15 minutes ago. He was on the verge of smoking it, having persuaded himself that after 11 months of abstinence it would be okay. His one regret about giving up smoking was that he had not consciously enjoyed that New Year's Eve night out, his last one ever. He had been too drunk. The only and proper way to refrain from this filthy, luxurious habit was to smoke a ton of them to the point of nausea, which he had, and then smoke the last one with ceremony, with grave and grieving concentration, gathering strength and determination, so that the final puff was a full stop, which he hadn't. There had been no goodbye, no bow, no final nicotine curtain. And this was what was holding him back in his life as a non-smoker. So he was going to allow himself to have that last one now. It was meant to be. It had been waiting for him all this time behind the vases. For a morning like this, when he woke up, desperate and needing and weak and depressed. The only problem was that he couldn't find a light. After much hungry and irritated searching, he had resolved to use the cooker. Risky. And had just opened the back door in preparation for his flight out into the garden when this was done. It was raining outside, but he was undeterred.
Damien!
With great reluctance, he went in the opposite direction towards the hall, returning the Marlborough to his pocket and continuing to fondle it. Why did she have to pick this moment to ask about a sheet? Why did he marry her? Why did he live on the outskirts of Dorking? What? He snapped. Stephanie was standing at the top of the stairs wearing Saturday morning cleaning clothes, tracksuit bottoms, an I Love Madrid t-shirt with no bra underneath, a navy blue and white bandana from which splayed wispy chestnut hairs, moccasins, and no makeup. It often struck him in moments like these how willingly she was colluding in her fading, and it briefly crossed his mind, for some freakish unknown reason, taking him by surprise, in fact, that when Melissa cleaned her house, she probably wore lip gloss, and perhaps some nice earrings or a nice top, and that should Michael come across her in this way, he probably experienced a mild and enduring satisfaction.
I bought a purple sheet last week from BHS and put it in the trunk and now it's gone, she said. It was fitted. It moulds around the corners of the mattress through a clever elasticated system so that I don't have to break my back folding the flaps under.
The tone of peevishness in her voice was down to a few things. First of all, she did not like his tone, and it annoyed her that she was being made to feel like a pest in going about the general and necessary maintenance of their domestic existence. Second of all, this tone was becoming indicative of his behaviour towards her as a whole. Irritability. Indifference. Neglect, even. Which she admitted to herself must be linked to the recent death of his father. The funeral was only a month ago. She was trying to be patient and understanding, but it was getting to be a strain. His moping around the house and practically ignoring the children, and going to bed deliberately much later than she did, and getting up earlier, like last night and this morning, for instance, so that they wouldn't have to actually communicate with each other. And when asked what was wrong and whether he wanted to talk about it, just saying that he was fine, when clearly he wasn't. And third of all, she hated it when people moved things around without telling her. And fourth of all, she really did hate folding sheet flaps, especially under their ridiculously heavy mattress that Damien had insisted on buying because it was cheaper than the memory foam that she had wanted. She was in the process of conducting a gradual sheet overhaul. Soon, every mattress in the house would wear fitted only, and if she was going to be snapped at in trying to achieve this small utopia, then, well, fatherless or not, she had no sympathy for him.
"I haven't seen a purple sheet," he said. "I don't even know what you're talking about."
"This house," Stephanie said sharply, raising her arm in a grand gesture to their ceilings, their walls and cupboards, and UPVC windows, and generous lawn, and to the Surrey Hills beyond,
"is a communal space, Damien. Do you know what that means? As in, we all live here together. You and me and our children. You have three of them? Their names are Jerry, Avril, and Summer. My name is Stephanie, and we are married, and married people talk to each other and tell each other their problems if something is troubling them. As she proceeded with this speech, Stephanie could feel herself becoming upset. She had acquired her sarcastic tongue from witnessing her older sister Charlotte's vituperative exchanges with their mother during adolescence. And she had only discovered that she had it in quite such a large proportion since being married to Damien. But it was wrong for him. It was too cruel. He was looking up at her with a sad, hostile, slightly baffled expression. She felt pity for him, but she continued.
And if there is something troubling you, which I know there is, well, now is the time to spit it out and weep on my shoulder, mister. Because if you carry on moping around the house like this, I am frankly going to lose it. It's hard losing a parent. I know it is. I know I'll feel just the same when my dad, well, I don't even want to think about it, but, oh, Damien, I wish you'd just talk to me.
Now she was crying. Not copiously weeping, which would be unlike her. But there were tears in her eyes, and her shoulders were fallen in pleading. Damien sensed that he should comfort her, which irritated him even more. He was still thinking about the Marlborough, still held in that moment of being about to smoke it. He could hear the rain on the other side of the front door, and was imagining it also falling on the other side of the back door, where it was waiting for him, the last one. He would look out at the sky and blow the smoke up to the water and feel washed away for a little while of all feeling, all obligation and emptiness, become the embodiment of emptiness itself. In an attempt to return to this brief, interrupted paradise, he placed one foot up on the first stair in a gesture of empathy, at which Stephanie took two steps down. More generous than him in her comparative psychological good health. He was supposed to say something. Look, Steph, I'm fine. Vituperation rose again within her, but she bore with him.
Don't be upset. I'm sorry. I guess I am a bit distant. It's just work, stuff, you know? I'm fine about Lawrence, honestly. It's really not a big deal.
Do you know how crazy that sounds? How can it not be a big deal? It still seemed strange and dysfunctional to Stephanie that Damien called his father by his first name. She had never heard him refer to him in the usual way. She had only met Lawrence a few times, once at the South Bank Centre in London for dinner with Damien when they were first together, another time at the wedding. She had found him rather stiff and abrupt, a bit condescending, not a happy man.
It's just not,
Damien said, again in that snappy tone.
We weren't close, I'm not devastated. You know we weren't that close.
Yes, I know. I know you weren't that close. But he was your dad. Stephanie stared at her husband for a second, as if she were looking at something in a fish tank, and realised that there was going to be no emotionally intelligent conclusion to this conversation. She would just have to give him time. She had said what needed to be said, and felt some relief, and now she was going to carry on with her Saturday, which after the cleaning would be spent in the rich and all-consuming company of her children. There was a toffee ship to make, a Buckingham Palace puzzle to complete, a swimming lesson to be attended, and, oh, now she remembered, dinner at Michael and Melissa's to meet the new baby. The thought of a tense drive up to London with Damien did not fill her with joy. She had bought a gift already, a packet of 100% cotton, 6 to 9 month baby grows, but maybe it should wait.
Are you sure you're up to going to dinner later? She said.
Do you want to cancel?
No.
No, you're not sure you want to go? Or no, you don't want to cancel. They're your friends. I'm not bothered.
No, we're going, he said. I'm fine.
You're fine?
Yes, I'm fine. Okay, fine. Whatever.
Stephanie turned, raising her eyebrows and her hands in exasperation, and started back upstairs. She was not going to let him ruin her day. Happiness was a human right.
Just remember I'm here if you need me. Don't shut me out. Blah, blah, blah. I'm going to find that sheet. And please don't forget to clean the bathrooms today.
Damien watched her disappear, feeling shitty. The excitement of the Marlboro was somewhat dampened, but he was going to smoke it anyway. He returned to the kitchen and ignited the cooker, only to discover, on retrieving the cigarette from his pocket, that he had broken it in his fondling. There was a slit right near the butt, in the most terminal and irreparable place. He didn't even have a Rizzler to fix it with. The vase cupboard had been cleared of all traces, all temptation, apart from this one accidental omission. The chance for nicotine closure was ruined. He held Stephanie personally responsible. Damien met Stephanie 15 and a half years ago at a fundraiser's conference in Islington when they were both living in London. He was working as a housing officer in Edgware, his first job after leaving university, and she was at the NSPCC in their fundraising department. She was tall, sturdy, and humble. Not specifically his type, in that she did not look like Lisa Bonet, Chilli from TLC, or Toni Braxton. But she was wholesome and attractive in a Kate Moss meets Alison Moyet kind of way, and she possessed something that Damien did not possess, an aptitude for contentment, which he found reassuring. She hailed from Leatherhead, a small town in North Surrey. Her father, Patrick, a former transport manager, owned a garden and outdoor furniture centre along the A24 towards Horsham, which he ran with his wife, Verena, Stephanie's mother, who was half Italian. Verena did the accounts and admin. Patrick did the marketing and customer relations. He was very big on advertising. Approximately 3 minutes past the garden centre on the A24 was an enormous sign stating, "You have just missed Britain's largest garden centre. Largest selection of UK and exotic buds, cane and garden furniture." Whether it was true that Patrick's garden centre really was the largest in Britain was a marginal issue for him, because it was very large, and it probably was the largest independent garden centre, definitely along a major A road, in this country. There were all kinds of loopholes in advertising that meant you could claim practically anything you wanted, he was always telling people. Patrick had worked in advertising during his youth, before the transport managing. He often told the story, urged on by a weak, defeated look on his son-in-law's face that made him want to kick him in the teeth and say, "Buck up, mate." But instead, he told the story. "I worked in advertising for years. Went straight into it from college. Thought, this is a load of, excuse my language, tripe. But then I got into it. You know, there's a lot you can do to influence people. Signs and symbols. They're all around us. We're being coaxed, nudged and seduced by them every minute. Only we don't know it. We think we're cleverer than that, but we're not. I've said this many times to Vera, haven't I, V? What makes people unhappy, a lot of the time, is that they think they should live outside the box. They think they're better than their lot. But really, we arrive where we arrive in accordance with our abilities and potential. I was actually a damn good advertising man, as I'm sure you're a damn good housing officer." This was last Sunday in the living room. The monthly in Lord Roast. "Research manager," Damien had clarified, as he had many times before. "I'm researching the effects of solar heat on large glass areas in multi-story blocks of flats." He could never seem to abbreviate this description. Every word seemed essential. "I started out as a housing officer." "And worked your way up. Good. Yes, that's good. And it sounds very interesting, doesn't it, V? Really interesting. Ecological, important," Verena said. "It is. Very important work," Stephanie said. "That's what I'm always telling him."
I'm sure it is, I'm sure it is.
Patrick redid a button that had come loose on his pink shirt. And I bet you're really good at it too, as I was at advertising. But, he went on, I had always wanted my own business, to be my own boss, master of my own kingdom and all that. But if I hadn't spent all those years in advertising and in transport also, that was useful too, well, to use a cliche, I wouldn't be where I am today, would I, V?
No, he wouldn't, would he, Steph?
No, Dad, you wouldn't.
That's right, my princess.
Mum, Dad, can I get you anything? Do you want more crisps, more cashews? The lamb's not quite ready yet.
I wouldn't mind some more of those crisps. What flavour are they?
Thai sweet chilli and sour cream.
Wow, the things they do to crisps these days, Patrick said. When I was a kid, there was just ready salted, cheese and onion, and salt and vinegar. When they brought in beef and onion, it was like caviar or something. It's like extraterrestrial television. The entrance of Channel 4 into the picture was enormous, wasn't it, V?
Oh, yes, massive.
Verena was on her third glass of wine.
Do you remember that, Steph?
Kind of, vaguely. Do you, Damien?
Yep. Well, because before that, there were only three channels. BBC One, BBC Two, and ITV. Remember Family Fortunes?
I used to love Family Fortunes.
You did, Steph. They had all the great shows on ITV. Benny Hill, Minder.
It's gone downhill a bit now. Everything's gone downhill because everyone's competing with everyone.
Yes, V. Exactly my point. Now, that's not a bad thing with crisps. Not if you get... What did you say the flavour was, Princess?
Thai sweet chilli and sour cream.
Yes. There's nothing wrong with a bit of healthy competition if you get amazing concoctions like that out of it. But when it means that people are making TV shows that they just know are, excuse my language, utter tripe, then it's just bad for entertainment, isn't it? I mean, what was wrong with Grandstand? Do you remember Grandstand?
How could I forget, Dad? You used to subject us to it every Saturday without fail.
Yes, Damien, he did. If any of us ever disturbed him, he'd get really, really annoyed.
I would. I love that show. And they've got rid of it. I just don't understand it.
And now, there's Football Focus instead, which is just not of the same calibre, in my opinion. Gary Lineker is a pillock. Excuse my language. He's all about the cool shirts and the baby face, and the ladies love him. But he's not a commentator. He's got nothing on Don Leverman. He may be a better-looking chap, but he hasn't got half the brains Don's got.
He's done a lot for crisps, though, Verena said.
Those adverts he did?
Only Walkers, though. They don't do all the new flavours, said Stephanie.
There you go, Patrick said, taking another crisp. A footballer turned ad man turned commentator. Brings me nicely back round to my point, Damien, he said. Just remember this. You can be whatever you want to be, but it's important to appreciate and learn from the roles we find ourselves in. One day, when the solar heat gets too much, well, it might be time to get out of the kitchen, so to speak. But for now, you have a very precious wife and two precious princesses, as well as this little prince here. Come here, you, to look after. You've got to bring home that bacon fella. And for now, that is your focus. Ha, football, focus, get it? Who knows what all this is leading towards, eh? The sky's the limit.
They were all looking sympathetically at Damien, while being duly impressed by Patrick's masterful cascade of puns.
Okay, thanks, Patrick, Damien said.
You're a brilliant researcher into the effects of solar heat on large glass areas in multi-story blocks of flats, Stephanie said.
I bet he is, said Verena.
Steph, do you need any help in the kitchen?
No thanks, Mum. Everything's under control. You just sit back and relax. Do you want some more wine?
It may partly be due to the long-lasting effects of these monthly in-laud roasts that Damien woke up this morning feeling weak and needing and depressed. They always left him with the sense that his life was wrong. Stephanie was wrong. This house was wrong. Everything was wrong. In the presence of her family, Stephanie seemed to revert to an earlier, more provincial, more sheltered self, a self raised on horse riding lessons and country hikes and stoic matrimony. A playroom looking out on the Surrey Hills, much like the one she had made in this house, in fact, and he found it difficult to extricate her from this peachy daddy's princess back into the bold, forthright, somehow cooler woman he had fallen in love with and married. Or had he really fallen in love at all? Was it just that she had made him feel adequate and dynamic? That she was focused and forthright in her plans for her life, when he was not, so he just went along with her? All she really wanted, she had told him very early on in a pub, was a family. I want children and a home and a husband. I'll work as well, but my job will be secondary. My children will be my work. I want to look after them. I'm not going to shove them in a nursery when they're 3 months old. I'm going to teach them their alphabet and take them to the park and help them paint pictures. I'm going to feed them. I'm old-fashioned, right? But I'm allowed to want those things. And so it was. A warm, gravel-fronted semi on a safe and quiet street. Swings in the back. Lawn. Stripy. A bamboo gazebo donated by Patrick, from which, of a summer's evening, the children appeared and peeped, their silk cheeks and soft hair. They adored their mother like the sun rising. They filled her up. She taught them to identify trees and see the good in each other, and be possessing of themselves. The school they attended was high-achieving and highly endorsed by the state. Jerry went to a good, bright nursery 3 mornings a week, while Stephanie worked at a local charity. There was a country park nearby, and 2 leisure centres, and they were spoilt for choice in their supply of warehouse DIY shops, economy global clothing brands, and chain eateries within driving distance, always returning to this big, warm and sturdy house, with its pale blue front door and the pale blue calico sofa in the living room, where you could sit and look out at the light and the leaves of the sessile oaks through the window opposite. Stephanie loved this house. She loved its neatness and thick upstairs carpets and old wooden surfaces. She loved how the neatness met with the chaos of children, their shoes, their felt tips, their plastic microphones, their dolls, their animal puzzles, their Lego, yet was never completely overcome by it, for she had developed an efficient system of storage around the house so that everything knew where it belonged, even if it did not always find itself there. The teddies, dolls, and soft animals lived in an orange IKEA compartmentalized hanging basket on the landing, the hook for which Damien had erected with some difficulty given his limited DIY skills. Another reason why Patrick found him unimpressive. The other, smaller objects representing any kind of human or animal life were kept in a plastic tray marked creatures, which could be slid in and out of a bulky pine-holding frame in the playroom, also containing several further trays, paper, for paper, colouring books, stickers and postcards. Noises, for rattles, musical instruments, whistles, etc. Objects, for inanimate toys, miniature furniture, shells, marbles, and so on. Stephanie had applied these labels during her free time between the school run, work, housework, and general household admin, as she had put up photographs of her, Damien, and the children around the rooms. It was indeed a house very similar to that in which she had grown up. Her childhood had been relatively happy, and she was brought easily to repeat it. She was content here. Contentment was simple. This was all a far stretch from where Damien had begun. He was not from Surrey, but from London, South London. He was a child of the Stockwell tenements. The lawn, if it was ever stripy, was communal. The staircases were outside rather than in. Four flights had led up to the front door, which was painted one of four state-offered colours. Red, black, blue, or green. Lawrence had chosen black. Alternatively, you could take the lift, but they were often used as toilets by dogs or drunks. Only the culprits knew the truth. Once you reached your floor, you waved your plastic fob key over the sensor, and a heavy metal-edged door released, opening onto a cold, narrow walkway. Inside each flat was a small bathroom, a small, windowless toilet, a small kitchen, a medium-sized living room, and one, two, or three bedrooms, depending on the size of the party. Lawrence and Damien's had two. There was also a balcony, which the tenants adorned according to their taste. Some were left bare, or used only for hanging out washing. Then some people really went to town, displaying hanging baskets and patio tables and potted trees and lanterns, showing real pride and aspiration in their outdoor space, throwing in a little flora, a little slice of Chelsea. Lawrence and Damien's balcony was mostly bare, apart from a bench and an ashtray on the windowsill. And stretched across the squared air was a sheet of tough green government netting to stop the pigeons from excreting on their turf. This was where Lawrence had done a lot of his thinking. Evening, night, morning, and afternoon. He was not green-fingered or house-proud. Thinking was everything. Lawrence Hope was a political activist and writer who had come to England from Trinidad as a teen and made a career of his outrage. He was among the crusaders, who had witnessed personally the landlords who would not give them rooms, and the police who would not let them go, and the thugs who would not let them be, and retaliated. He had rioted, organised, and campaigned. He wrote articles about the pernicious violations of racism, gave speeches in dim community halls about the need for action and the importance of black unity. "Without unity, we are lost," he would say to Damien, over breakfast or while watching the evening news or on a Saturday night in the smoky living room in the company of fellow crusaders. The community halls had eventually advanced into lecture theatres, and the articles were picked up by the newspapers. Lawrence Hope's book of essays on the struggle for racial equality in Britain was considered a notable volume in academia, and was still a set text on some university courses. He had never published another book, and he never managed to secure a permanent university post. But he had carried on writing, in the corner of his bedroom, which he used as a study. Even when the commissions faded and the request for speeches dwindled, when the movement, as he saw it, crumbled, and the world turned away and turned in on itself, and the legacies of Thatcher made people selfish. He carried on working and thinking until his outrage became the only world he had left, and he shrunk with it, became thin and alone. "We are still not free," he would tell Damien. "They think they are free, but they are not. There's still lots of work to be done." Damien would be haunted, worried by this work that still had to be done. He would look at the bookshelves lining the walls in his father's room, bearing Fanon, Baldwin, Wright, and Dubois. Those haloed, courageous men who had spent their lives doing this very important work. And he would wonder how he was going to continue this very important work, when all he wanted to do some days was just come home from school and watch Neighbours, and not think about how or why there were no black people in Neighbours, and eat shepherd's pie, or lasagna, or something that people ate in happy homes, where there was someone around who cooked. A woman's touch. That thing. That bright, tender, and colourful thing. A woman's presence. The lack of it made him sexist. He wanted a woman to come and put flowers on the windowsill and make the balcony like Chelsea. Wash curtains. Change sheets. He fantasised, coming up the stairs to the fourth floor, that he could smell not the clinical funk of a government stairway, but spices, marinades, tomatoes, chicken, wafting out from underneath the black door, the braising of his supper, the hot food of her love. This woman that Damien longed for was not his mother. His mother had left and gone to Canada when Damien was 5 and had never returned, and he practically forgot her. The woman he longed for, after she too had left, was named Joyce, an ex-girlfriend of his father's, who had come for a while and made it nice. Joyce was also from Trinidad, though more recently arrived. She was lighter, breezy. She still held the whisper of the island. She wore colourful skirts that swayed in the air. In the winter months, a purple cardigan with gold buttons down the front, and she had wonderfully soft hands. She cooked the best food Damien had ever tasted, better than the takeaway on Brixton Road, where he and his father were regular customers. Her marinades were high on pepper. Her rice and peas was flaky. She made ginger cake and bought pineapples and sliced them from their cores. They all ate together around the folding table in the living room, previously a dusty surface for stray folders and empty glasses, now permanently opened out, bearing a bowl of fruit and, yes, flowers. She said that men were boys and boys were men, and both of them needed women to help them live. "Damien," she would say. "Wipe your mouth with a napkin when you finish." "Damien," she would say. "I see you have on that same shirt from yesterday. You must change it." And they talked around the table about their days and their lives. Lawrence was loosened. He was laughing. Damien discovered things about him that he had not known before. Things about his childhood in Trinidad which he hardly ever talked about, as if it were not significant. As if it were only England that had made him who he was. As if he did not exist before he became angry. The call of the crusade backed away in the light of Joyce's presence, and his father also. For a while, became light. But the relationship did not last. Lawrence eventually got tired of sharing his room with someone else and complained that he couldn't think. Joyce began to accuse him of the same things Damien's mother had once accused him of. That he was cold, blinkered, selfish, arrogant. That he didn't take her out. He didn't make her feel good anymore. He didn't appreciate her. The smell of marinade became less frequent as Damien climbed the 4 flights of stairs. And one evening, as he unlocked the front door, he heard them arguing. Joyce said to his father that he did not know how to be with a black woman. She said he could only be with white women, because white women did not need to be respected in the way that black women did. Lawrence told her to get out. He was angrier than Damien had ever seen him. Late that night, in the darkness of his bedroom, Damien felt her soft form sitting close by him, a soft hand brushing the side of his face. He did not open his eyes because he knew that she was going, and he did not want to say goodbye. The sway of her fabric as she stood, the tread of her feet across the floor, followed by a complete silence as she paused by the door. The next morning, she was gone. The flat returned to its original austerity. Lawrence returned with greater doggedness to his gloomy desk. The treatment of black people by the police, the handling of the Brixton riots, the disproportionate number of black men in mental hospitals and in prison. All of this had left Damien with a sense of obligation to do something important with his life, like a Mali or a Kuti. He should continue his father's work, accept his position in the social strata, as a vessel of ongoing change. But on trying to decide what degree to take at university in the inception of this vocation, he came up against a wall. Deep in his heart, he wanted to take English, but he felt he should choose politics or sociology, and rebelling against this feeling of what he should do, he chose instead to do philosophy, and spent 3 years adding doubtful, theoretical, and literary scaffolding to the very large question of what everything meant. Why do we exist? Do we actually exist? What is the meaning of human life? What is the purpose of religion? He left university with a deeper vagueness about the future and allowed himself to be commissioned, through Lawrence's contacts, to write occasional book reviews and to help with research for a documentary he had been working on for 12 years about the legacies of the slave trade. Meanwhile, he considered postgraduate degrees in English as a way of backtracking to the original impulse, but by then the sensation had already arrived that it was too late. He turned to the job market. That situation's vacant that represented the safe dead end of dangerous dreaming, and after several interviews found himself in a communal office in Edgware, drafting tenancy agreements and writing eviction letters and coordinating claims for housing benefits. It was not what he had imagined for himself, but he saw it as a stopgap until he discovered what he really wanted. He read books. He read Shakespeare, Kafka, and Flannery O'Connor. He read Raymond Carver and yearned to capture the piercing moments of lives. And he began, in the evenings, sitting in his room in Kennington at an old-school desk he found in a junk shop, the kind that lifts up to reveal a compartment underneath, to write a novel. It was a coming-of-age story, about a man in his 20s trying to find himself. He worked on it for a year, smoking cigarette after cigarette, wearing short socks and long shorts, so that only his calves were bare. This was very important. The draft around the shins, it helped him concentrate, making copious notes and reading relevant-seeming books on psychology and identity. At some point, though, he came up against another wall. He became confused. The words tripped over one another. Every time he tried to write a sentence, the idea of it in his head shriveled and turned to ash, a kind of impotency, and he could not go on with it. It was around this time that he met Stephanie. Standing there, next to him in her red shoes, aisle 3 of the Islington Business Design Centre. Red-brown hair, clear, pale skin. A little bit taller than him, frank, brown eyes, and a gentle way of watching. She asked him if he knew, according to this overcomplicated conference map, where she would find the seminar room. And they went on a friendly mission to find it together. It was clear from the beginning that she liked him. She was direct about it. She was focused. He looked, she thought, and later revealed to him, exactly like a man she had seen in a recent dream. A little stocky, going towards chubby. Large hands, close dark curls and light brown skin. Charging suddenly into her dream as if he were looking for something. Maybe, he told her, I was looking for you. Maybe you were, she said, as they lay in his room with Bobby McFerrin playing on the turntable, vinyl sleeves spread across the floor, her red shoes touching toes, discarded beneath the school desk. They walked all over the city together with her in those shoes. Gigs, pubs, restaurants, movies, mulled wine in a Camden twilight. The river from the banks of Hammersmith, the city which for her was temporary. She would go back to the hills, she said, with this family, these children she knew that she would have, and they would run across the fields making flying shapes and flying kites. They would ride horses. They would know the woods and the meadows. There are woods and meadows in London, Damien had said. But no, they are not the same, she said. You hear traffic still, and sirens, and helicopters hover. I hate hovering helicopters. They make me think of air raids. The argument continued as they rented a flat together in Dulwich, where they frequented the woods, became married people, and walked in the woods now with Summer strapped to Stephanie's torso in a Mama's and Papa's baby carrier, until one day, while driving through the back streets of Forest Hill, with Summer peacefully asleep in the Mama's and Papa's car seat, Stephanie saw three men walking along the pavement in broad daylight towards the mini roundabout, one of them holding a rock the size of Summer's head, which he was aiming at the head of one of the other men, while the third man was trying to stop him from throwing it. Stephanie did not stop to see whether the man actually threw the rock. But the murderousness in his face was terrifying, and she went home and told Damien that very evening that she was moving back to Surrey, whether he liked it or not, and had no ears when Damien tried to argue that people in the home counties probably also got their heads smashed in sometimes with large rocks. Patrick and Verena were pleased. They helped them out with a deposit on a starter house in Dorking, 3 miles east from the town centre, then again on this bigger house, this final house on Raleigh Road when Stephanie was pregnant with Avril. Damien was adamant that they would pay them back, but so far they had not. He had changed jobs twice since meeting Stephanie, but had still not managed to get out of housing, only to a higher echelon of it, at a residential research consultancy in Croydon. On his journey to work now, he hardly even needed to touch the surface of London. He could avoid the tube completely. He could join the other commuters flocking into East Croydon station at 5:20 p.m, with the steely office blocks and tall silver scrapers of that strange spaceship town looming above them, and board a crowded train bound on smooth, efficient rail tracks out towards the countryside. The crowd gradually decreasing, the green increasing. The city long gone, arriving home in time to help Stephanie put the children to bed. Sometimes he got home early enough to eat dinner with them and listen to them recounting their days. The times tables beat the clock scores, the trip to the farm, the Christmas carol concert, Stephanie's updates on insurance renewals and swimming lesson bookings and forthcoming local fun fairs or circuses that they might attend. There was so much to think about and so much to do with all this activity and responsibility that he hardly had time to really consider how he missed London, the hum of it, the Brixton roar and the beloved river, the West Indian takeaways, the glittering of the tower blocks at night, the mobile phone shacks, the Africans in Peckham, the common proximity of Plantain, the stern beauty of churchwomen on Sunday mornings, the West End, the art in the air, the music in the air, the sense of possibility. He missed the tube, the telephone boxes. He even missed, deep down, the wicked parking inspectors and the heartless bus drivers who flew past queues of freezing pedestrians out of spite. He missed riding from Loughborough to Surrey Quays on his bike, with the plane trees whizzing by. The sight of some long-weaved woman walking along in tight jeans and a studded belt and look-at-me boots, and maybe a little boy holding her hand. The skylines, the alleyways, and yes, the sirens, and helicopters, and the hit of life. All these things he knew so well. And the fact, most of all, that he belonged there in a way that he would never, could never, belong in Dorking. He was outside, displaced. He was off the A to Z. He felt, in a very fundamental way, that he was living outside of his life, outside of himself. And the problem was, if indeed it was a problem, how could you call something like this a problem when there were bills to pay, and children to feed, and a house to maintain? The problem was that he did not know what to do about it, how to get rid of this feeling, how to get to a place where he felt that he was in the right place. And this not being such a serious problem, not really a problem at all, he had suppressed it and accepted things as they were. He rode his bike to the station in the mornings, though lately he had stopped this and was becoming chubby, as Stephanie had predicted. He boarded the train and entered the spaceship town and re-emerged from it and came home and talked about pressing domesticities while all of his doubts, worries, yearnings and melancholic nigglings were stored away in a cupboard with his unfinished novel, where they had remained quiet, neat and generally manageable. Until around about now. Lawrence died of congestive heart failure in a hospice on the north side of Clapham Common. He retreated to a no-way-back place. His breath gave up on infinity. Damien was with him in the final days, as he sank into the sheets, as his skin became ashen, his eyes yellow, as he turned his face to the left and stopped, right there. In the deep of a September night. It was strange when it happened, because Damien had felt almost nothing. He watched him die. He'd fallen asleep in the chair next to the bed and woke up suddenly, at just the right time, as if Lawrence had called to him with his small, awful cough, as if he did not want him to miss it. He knew straight away that something had changed, that his father was going, that this was the moment. So he watched it, this man passing into dust, receding into immediate history, his vanishing. This old man from whom he came, but apart from a faint reaching inside of him, a faint call with the arms of his heart, he felt nothing. He stood there for a while afterwards, looking just to the left of Lawrence's face at the white pillow, then back at the face. Then he went out of the hospice and walked in the surrounding streets, sensing that the world was different now, but not quite being able to feel it. He had expected to feel lonely in a new way, to begin a process of reconstruction in which Lawrence would walk out into a chamber of his mind, white-robed and holy, ennobled by his pain and glittering with a wisdom from the other side. He had expected to cry, or to be angry, or in some way ethereal and connected to heaven, but nothing happened. The clouds did not change. There was no message in the trees. He returned home, and in the following days went about the busy administration of death. Lawrence died on a Thursday, just after midnight. On the Monday morning, Damien went back to work. What he did feel was something else, something specific, yet ambiguous, that came to him the morning after the funeral as a 17-word question. There was no voice attached to the question. It was very faint, an accumulation of yearnings, and once it had been asked, it would not go away. The question was this: how long will you go on living your life as if you were balancing on a ribbon? He did not quite understand what it meant. It was teasing, flimsy, yet urgent, like a trick. It followed him everywhere he went. It was in his head now, as he emerged from the cleaning of the downstairs toilet, still wearing his dressing gown. As he came through the kitchen, whose gangway was presently taken up by the home base extra-large ironing board and a pile of washing, as he wandered through into the dining room, tired of this house, its daytime gloom, its demeaning regularity, the frivolous, frankly tacky gazebo. He hated that gazebo. "How long?" it said. "How long will you go on living your life as if you were balancing on a ribbon?" Contrary to Stephanie's assumption, Damien was actually looking forward to going to Michael's place that afternoon. He and Michael went back a long way. They had been at university together. They used to have deep discussions about Franz Fanon and race and black music in the student union bar. And Damien had come to feel that he owned these things for himself, not just through his father. Once Damien got together with Melissa, they had made the effort to keep in touch, meeting for drinks or having dinner together as a foursome. Damien always enjoyed these dinners, the sharing of food, the playing of music. They always talked about the music and films and books. He would come away feeling happier and reconnected to the floundering artistic side of himself. At times, on returning home, after Stephanie had gone upstairs to bed and the house was still, he would even go to the cupboard in the dining room, where he kept his old folders and papers, and take out the unfinished novel and look at it. He would just sit on the floor and look at it, and it would seem possible again. He would read some of the sentences and think about how they could be improved, how the whole thing could be massaged and rearranged to become a rich, complete thing. Then he would put it back in the cupboard with a firm intention to work on it the following evening, except that he never did. He blamed this, also, on Stephanie. In the dining room, he came across a girl sitting at the table. She was holding a wafer and dipping it into a pot full of thick, rust-brown liquid. She was softly auburn-haired and concentrating. She did not raise her eyes. A slice of pale and sudden sun, a respite from the rain, fell to the left of her, into which she seemed to look, as if it contained the instructions to her activity. Damien often came across his children like this, like droplets of light appearing suddenly. Their purity kept breaking his heart. The newness of their lives startled him, that he was responsible for carrying them, that whatever he did, whoever he was, would shape them. It was Avril, the middle child, 6 years old.
"Hi, darling," he said. "What are you doing?"
"I'm making a toffee ship."
"Wow."
"And afterwards,"
she said in amazement,
"we're going to eat it."
"Who is?"
"All of us. You, me, Summer, Jerry and Mummy. The whole family."
Chapter 3. Mrs. Jackson. In Bell Green, also, there was cleaning. The windowsills, the shelves, the side tables, the floors. That life-usurping, burdensome act of servitude and futility that returned week after week to remind you of your never-ending domestic obligation and hopeless mundanity. Melissa despised cleaning. It was not therapeutic, refreshing, or creatively stimulating, as some people like to argue. It was just dust in your face, and she went about it with huge reluctance and discontent, wearing faded, paint-splashed dungarees and a top with holes in it, and a look on her face that gave vivid indication of what she would look like as an old woman. Now that there was a whole house to clean, her misery was intensified, and dragging her cloth around the living room, halls and bedrooms, she could hear millions of tiny dust particles laughing at her from their swirling microscopic freedom, screaming hilariously as she approached the static black sheen of the TV stand where dust settled even as she wiped, and dancing and tittering in the light from the skylight as she clattered over the stairs with the Hoover. Usher and Beres Hammond provided some comfort. Music was power, but nothing could appease her until it was over. It was unfortunate, then, that 13 Paradise Row was an especially dusty house. It was built circa 1900 upon a gently sloping plot of shrinkable clay subsoil, typical to much of South London and requiring homeowners to have insurance policies in place against subsidence. Because of this sloping, this possible shrinking and sinking, there was that sense of crookedness and a damp close to the ground, a feeling almost nautical. The floors tipped down in a faint eastward direction. Corners were not quite, skirting boards were jagged, struggling to sit fast against the walls in a mutual failure to make right angles. The dust nestled easily into the cracks of these failures. It settled on top of the dado rail along the upward tunnel of the staircase. It clung through this moistness, this dampness in the air, inside the grooves of the wood-panelled wall in the dining area, where a row of kid-height hooks held the children's coats. There was dust atop the door frames, the picture frames, the lampshades. In the master court, it was worst of all. The headboard of Camden was afflicted, the upper edge of the dancers at twilight. There was mildew in the wardrobes, which gave off a musty, ancient smell, and while Melissa bent to neaten the line of shoes between the two, she found for the second time a moist, white film of something on their soles, which came off on her fingertip. Michael was out walking Blake. Ria was in the next room doing something with a cardboard box and muttering to herself, as she often did. The muttering stopped. She called out with a high-pitched urgency,
"Mummy!"
Footsteps followed. She appeared at the door, hand on hip.
"Mummy, why do you always throw away my things?"
"I don't always throw away your things." Melissa